All the trials, sorrows, and sufferings incident to birth and the few years in your physical world were necessary, and from my present vantage ground the matter of living a few years more or less, the manner of my going were unimportant. It is all forgotten now in the wonderful reality about me. As soon as I came to understand what death was and to what it led, I immediately commenced to complete my education, and build a home for the wife and children, and I am happy to tell you that again we dwell together, for they are all here in this land of happiness and opportunity. In the presence of such an experience, listening to an individual speaking from the world beyond, telling of another, an unknown land, where all the so-called dead live, think, move, develop, and progress, the learned should understand and comprehend that three dimensions and five senses do not explain the conditions beyond. The spring blew trumpets of color, her green sang in my brain. I saw a blind man groping tap-tap with his cane, I pitied him his blindness. But can I boast I see, perhaps there walks a spirit close by, who pities me, a spirit who hears me tapping the five-sensed cane of the mind. Amid such unknown glories I may be worse than blind. Chapter 3 Speech with the Dead. Twas in the year 1892 that I met Emily S. French. She was a woman then over 60 years of age, in delicate health, and very deaf. While she was conscious that she possessed powers out of the ordinary, she had little more comprehension than I of that into which the force would develop. At the suggestion of a number of prominent citizens, I was asked to meet Mrs. French and explain, if I could, the unusual phenomena obtainable. In one of our early investigations we sat in a dark room, three of us forming a half circle, she facing us. After a time, seeming whispers were faintly heard, and the gentleman sitting with me insisted that he recognized his wife's voice. It was unsatisfactory to me, but I was interested and immediately made an investigation of the character of the psychic. Finding her of good family and of more than ordinary education, I determined to know how the phenomenon was produced. Of course, at that time I could not comprehend the direct voice, nor the possibility of speech with the so-called dead. I was then agnostic. As I look over the situation now, I see that I had neither the experience nor the ability to appreciate the facts, any more than the average reader of this book can comprehend some of the statements made in it. I had to learn, first, that the afterlife is etheric, and that people take into the afterlife the same spirit body which they had in this life divested of the outer flesh garment. In those days I did not know that we have etheric bodies. I found in the beginning that Mrs. French stood very much in awe of the play of this psychic force. One always fears things which he does not understand, and not understanding the unusual phenomena present, she was often very much afraid. I investigated far enough to find that she was possessed of a vital force unknown to me. She was just as much in the dark regarding it as I, and just as much interested. Accordingly, she undertook to join me in an investigation, to devote her time without money and without price to the mastery of that force in the hope that good might come. Out of that compact came over 20 years of continued work, and experiences which to me seem worthy of record. It has been said that we have but five senses. That is to say, the average individual has but five senses developed. Some persons, however, have seven. To the five accepted senses I add psychic sight and psychic hearing. Mrs. French possessed both of those. At times she could see people moving in the afterlife, not with her physical eye, of course, but by means of psychic sight. She could perceive them so acutely that they were just as real to her as if an impression came upon the retina. This is true, because she could see and describe these people in the dark just as well as in the light. Again, she had psychic hearing, for I have been able on many occasions in the broad daylight to carry on conversations with persons out of the body, she repeating their words, as satisfactorily as if they were still in their physical bodies. And in such talks I have gone frequently far beyond the knowledge of the psychic. In the beginning spirit speech was faint from the sphere beyond. I was able to get in touch with only a very ordinary class of spirit people, and I often became impatient that those I most desired did not come. I did not then understand as I now do my own limitations, for now I know that instruction was being given me as fast as I could grasp it. When a new fact was stated, The law and the conditions making such fact possible were explained. The first propositions were very simple, but as the years rolled by, we made great progress. We learned how to form the required environment. There was a whisper and then a voice, then the voice took tone and individuality. In course of time, those of the group with whom I was accustomed to have speech were easily recognized. There was one person in particular with whom, from the very first time I worked with Mrs. French, I was desirous of talking. This was my mother, who left this life in 1873. Time went on, and she did not come. Finally, she requested me to meet with Mrs. French under the necessary conditions on May 26, 1896, saying that she would come and go over many things in which we were mutually interested. About 10 o'clock on the appointed morning, the Brown Building in Buffalo, then being repaired, collapsed. The street was full of rumors that many people had been killed. The number was put, I think, at 6 or 7. Of course, there was no way of ascertaining the truth until the debris could be removed, and this would require many days. Mrs. French and I were scarcely seated that evening when my mother greeted me in her own direct voice, and said with great regret that owing to the accident that morning she must forego the pleasure of our visit until a later time. We could be of great help to those whose lives had been crushed out, they needed assistance. Of course, I readily acquiesced in the suggestion. There was perhaps 10 minutes of silence, then a voice, choking and coughing, broke the stillness and cried, "My God, the building is falling, the building is falling. This way, this way." The situation was tense and startling. I half rose to my feet. Another voice answered in a strange tongue. The words were not distinguishable, but it seemed to me as if someone was responding to the first call, which was followed in a moment by a woman's voice crying out in great fear, "We will all be killed. Help me, help me." This was the beginning of what we term our mission work, that is, helping to restore consciousness to those who, in leaving the old body, are not readily able to regain that condition. There was then, aiding in this work, as I have since learned, a group of 7 spirit co-workers who had brought to us these unfortunate people whose spirit bodies had been crushed out in the fall of this building. We were to restore them to a normal mental condition, and acting upon the suggestion of the spirit co-workers, I quietly talked with them. After a time, I told them what had occurred and brought them to a realization of their situation. Eventually, they came to understand that in the fall of that building their spirits had been forced from their physical bodies, and when they came to realize that in the catastrophe they had gone out of earth life, their sorrow was beyond words. One told me on that evening that 4 people, namely, William P. Straub, George Metz, Michael Schkirtsk, a Pole, and Jenny M. Griffin, a woman, had lost their lives in the fall of the building. This was verified some days later. After talking with me, voice to voice, they realized that they had gone through the change called death. Then their friends in the afterlife came, were recognized, and took them and gave them such consolation as was possible under the unfortunate circumstances. I asked the leader of the spirit group how it was that the voices when first heard seemed so strained, and speech so broken, why there was so much choking. He replied that a person, crushed out of the physical body suddenly, finishes as soon as consciousness and the mental condition are restored, sentences left unuttered when dissolution came, that in the awakening he takes on the identical state in which he passed out. After they had gone, Mrs. French said, "I see behind you a man probably 55 or more years old, strong character I should judge, who has been listening to this conversation. He is looking at you with amazement. He does not seem to understand." I said to her, "Does he know me?" She replied, "He answers, yes." "Does he give his name?" "No, not yet." Of course, being in absolute darkness and not possessing psychic sight or psychic hearing, I could neither see nor hear him, but I asked, "Did he reside in Buffalo?" She answered, "No." I then inquired concerning other localities, and named residents of a city where I had lived for some years, asking, "Was he a resident of that city?" And Mrs. French replied, saying, "He says that he lived there." Then I repeated the names of many of my acquaintances, trying to identify the individual who was then present, with an idea that I might have speech with him. Finally, Mrs. French said, I see the letters H, G, B. I quickly recalled the individual described and spoke his name. He had been a leading citizen of a neighboring city, a large manufacturer. I recalled many evenings spent at his house with his family, and particularly did I recall his voice. On Sunday evenings he enjoyed the gathering of young people, and at such times there was often singing of popular songs, and many of the old hymns. His voice was unusual, deep, resonant, and he sang very well. It was a voice which, having once been heard, could never be mistaken. He had been out of the body then about 5 years. After a little time he moved around apparently to the side of Mrs. French, and greeted me. That deep masculine voice would have been recognized if he had not given his name, there was no mistake. He spoke my name as familiarly as he ever did in earth life, and I greeted him as cordially as I ever had in his home. I had believed that this man had led an exemplary life, for this was the general impression which prevailed in the community where he resided, and I thought he, of all men, would find the best conditions after dissolution. However, he did not yet realize that he had separated from his physical body. He knew some great change had taken place, but he had absolutely no conception of what it was, although 5 years had elapsed since it occurred. He told me that his wife and children no longer recognized him in his own home, that he spoke to them, that he called to them, that he got on his knees and shrieked their names, but he could not apparently touch them. He could not make them realize his presence, they passed him apathetically. His inability to make himself known in the home where he had always been the dominant personality, the indifference with which he was treated not only by his own family but by others with whom he came in contact, had driven him nearly to desperation. He could not understand the situation at all, and he was fearful that he was verging on insanity, if not completely insane. All was darkness about him, all things were unnatural, and he had become frantic. It was a delicate task to bring this man to a realization of the great change that had taken place, because his present condition was so intensely real. He was the same man. He had the same intellect, the same personality, apparently the same body. Why should he be ignored and overlooked by all whom he had known? It was only after many explanations that he came to a realizing sense that he had left the physical world of men. Having in mind the exemplary life which he had led, I told him that I could not understand why he should find himself in such a mental state, and he replied that he had not lived the life for which he had been given credit. A member of the spirit group present said, "The wrong done in earth life binds him to the earth condition. While he has left his physical body, he has not left the earth and its environment, and having no knowledge of the great beyond to which he has journeyed, he has never progressed beyond the earth plane where he formerly lived, and he cannot comprehend while in that mental state the change that has come to him." It appeared that he had never left his home, and the narrow environment about it, but in a half-awakened, half-conscious state had wandered from one to another until by good fortune he had been told that if he would attend upon our work, he would understand the change that had come into his life. With this unusual experience we said good night to our group of co-workers, and I walked homeward in deep thought. What shall be said of our civilization that teaches nothing of the conditions prevailing in the afterlife? Chapter 4 Told in the afterlife. If there is one thing this world ought to know, does not know, and wants to know, it is the process in which and by which an inhabitant of this plane of consciousness leaves the physical body to become an inhabitant of the next or etheric plane. I speak of the earth and the etheric plane, of a here, and a hereafter that I may be understood, but technically this, the next, and all planes of existence are one, differing only in vibratory activity, or modes of motion. The universe is all a part of one stupendous whole. Only one who has made the great change, can adequately describe conditions under which people live in the sphere beyond. For many years I have been exchanging with other psychic scientists reports of conditions and lectures from this source. T. W. Stanford of Australia sent me a communication from the afterlife received by him, which my group say is a statement of fact, and, therefore, with his permission I quote it as follows. In my weakness I became unconscious of all around, but soon I became conscious of several things. I realized that something that had held me down and fatally gripped me was gone. I was free, and in the place of weakness and pain and sickness, I had a virility and a vigor which I had never known upon the earth plane. I was also aware that I was in new surroundings, most beautiful. Then I became conscious that I was in the midst of a company of fellow souls, whose voices were filled with happiness, all welcoming me, and others whom I had temporarily lost while upon the earth plane. I then knew that some great change had occurred which had taken from me everything that I had desired to get rid of, or some power, had given to me a delightful experience, which I had often in a measure imagined, but dared scarcely believe that it could be possible. Surrounded by an innumerable company, I was quite dazzled with the appearance of some who, it was explained to me, were exalted personages. Then there approached one who seemed to be the chief speaker. He said before me was the universe, that time was for me no more, that I was henceforth an inhabitant of a new country. You will ask me, was it all pleasant? Extremely so. How can I illustrate it so that you will understand? Have you ever after taking a long journey become extremely tired and weary, and, at last, at the end of much striving and traveling, come to a house of rest? How you sank down upon the downy couch. Oh, the delight of it! With no dreams to disturb your rest, you awoke like a giant refreshed. To me it was something like that, although even that is a weak illustration. But that which brought me greatest happiness was the knowledge that I had gained what I had once believed I had lost. I had health, strength, vitality, friends, and relatives restored to me forevermore. I have always been fond of the beautiful. I have spent days, weeks, and months in the picture galleries of Europe, looking at the work of the old masters. Many of them lived hundreds of years before I came upon the earth plane, and yet I seem to have known them all the days of my life. I have dreamed about them. Da Vinci had always been my companion, Murillo a choice comrade, for Giotto I had a deep, lasting friendship. I loved the beautiful in all its forms. I loved nature, the beautiful lakes of Italy and Switzerland, the glorious mountains, the everlasting hills. My friends in spirit life said to me, come and see the house beautiful. Try and understand, if you can, that not only are the landscapes spiritual, but so is the beauty of all that there is on the other side of life. The physical is only the gross imitation of the spiritual. There is no tongue which can describe the beauty of the spiritual realms, wherein are the souls of those who have just entered on their progressive existence, souls who have striven to do their best according to their light. I say that there is no tongue that can describe the beauties of that land. Take the best that you have, and it is poor in comparison. Then I came next to the spiritual houses, and there I met with more friends, more relatives, and, greater, grander still, with those royal souls who had been my affinities on earth, been companions, comrades of the brush and palette, and others whom I had deeply reverenced in my soul. But I found them much greater, grander, nobler than they ever were in their earth life, and I was privileged to be one of their companions. Still I pressed onward. I came next to a rest house. That will sound peculiar. You will say, how can you have rest houses, if you don't know what it is to be weary? No, there is no weariness like that you have experienced on earth, but there are rest houses, where in the spiritual life we may rest and have delightful intercourse with our friends. In the spiritual rest houses, therefore, we entered, and found there our relatives and friends. Some were not upon the same plane of existence as I was, but they had been permitted to come down to my sphere to meet me, so that in effect I could say, he that was dead is alive again, he that was lost for a time is found. And then memory, think of the joy of memory. I had carried personality and memory into the spirit world, and I compared the existence in Rome with that which I was then enjoying. I tell you that it was the expectancy of what was still to be which gave me the greatest pleasure and the greatest joy. There is no joy on earth like that which is in heaven, for it is unalloyed. I became conscious that I had to do something, and that I should have to work, and it was a joy. Could I be a messenger? I thought of some on the earth plane I had loved so dearly, and remembered that they were in spiritual darkness. I inquired, where is the heaven of orthodoxy? It does not exist, was the answer. Where is the purgatory of which I have been told so often? It does not exist. But my friends were in darkness, and a yearning came that I might go to them and tell them what I knew. I wanted to say, "Do not be mistaken, there is something better, brighter, grander, nobler for human souls than has been taught you." I was told that I could return, and became conscious that I could communicate with those still on earth if I found a certain channel, an avenue, an instrument. How could I find it? "All things are yours," is the promise. Therefore I must find the way and the instrument. This I did, and you have helped me. That is the work which I am doing, and it gives me increased happiness. I was told that there were greater beauties of the spiritual landscape which I had not yet seen, and which I could not yet understand, because the universe is illimitable. There is something overpoweringly grand in the thought that you are not cramped or shut up in a small space of a few millions of miles. No, this universe is vast, and the field is mine to explore. It became mine by right. I had worked for it, and I had yet to work for it. Take special note of that. I was to work and earn the right to explore God's dominions, and get happiness from every place, state, and condition of my spiritual existence. Do you like grand architecture? From what source do you think that the old Greeks got their first designs? Phidias and Praxiteles were, no doubt, the greatest of Greek sculptors. There were wonderful architects in those days. When I was upon the earth plane, I made a 9 months tour of Greece, Rome, and Sicily to make a study of the architecture of the ancients. I visited every temple, whether in ruins or in perfect order, and I tell you they are heaps of stones. They are utterly beneath contempt compared with the spiritual architecture of the homes and houses in the spirit world. If you have a spiritual body, there is no reason why you should not have a spiritual house. Get rid of the idea that you are a puff of wind in the life hereafter. Even wind may be solidified, for wind is atmosphere in motion, and it is possible to solidify the atmosphere. Then I came to the inhabitants of that spirit world. I had never previously believed or dreamed that these could exist in such beautiful forms. To most people, beauty of form is a source of joy and comfort. The Greeks and the Romans loved beauty of form, and I know that you do likewise. I saw the most exquisite forms as I progressed, and every day, to use language which you will understand, I met with some that I had previously known upon the earth plane, and what words can tell the joy of it? To some of them I had done little acts of kindness. And let me impress upon you that of all the pleasure I have received on the spirit side of life, the most came from those to whom I had previously done some act of kindness. If I had my earth life again, I would spend every hour in doing good, I would spend my life in doing acts of kindness. In our spiritual rest houses we frequently meet, not only with loved ones, but with those whom we reverenced and adored. We make also new acquaintances. We get in knowledge of great and grand souls, and come in contact with them. After a time, I was appointed by an intelligence to do a certain work. I was to help others to see the light, and I had permission to come back to the earth again. Then my instructor said, "That which will give you the greatest pleasure, do." Then I came back. I have met with many great and noble characters, who lived upon the earth plane. I am frequently in the companionship of those whom I loved, and I have never yet found cause for offense, and never will. No one has entered into my surroundings who has caused me a moment of sadness. On the earth plane even your best moments are clouded because someone in your midst was objectionable to you. But each one on the spirit side has gravitated to a certain spiritual level. If he be good, then his spiritual status is good, his affinities will be good, and those who come in immediate contact with him will be good also. There will be no one to offend. So vast are the realms or dominions of nature that in the few years I have been on the spirit side of life, I have been able to explore but little. When I have been upon the etheric plane for some billions of years I shall perhaps have seen a little of it. But throughout the countless ages of eternity I shall be evolving, developing, getting knowledge and light and wisdom. I shall become in tune with the infinite. What there is beyond I do not yet know. Even on our side of life we are not given more knowledge than we can make use of for the time being. It is all a matter of progression. I have told you that we all have to work. There are no drones. but it is work that is congenial and satisfactory, it is a labor of love. It is appointed by a higher intelligence, it is given to you to do, and if you do it, your progress and happiness are assured. Realize that there is no coercion on the spirit side of life, but the spiritual eyes are open to their responsibility. They see everything at a glance. In the spirit side of life you are not left in any doubt. You have full knowledge that to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to do the will of God is to bring happiness in your progressive existence, throughout eternity. Mothers have had their children taken away by death, and the bereaved ones say, "We have lost our children." You have not lost them. They may have been lost from vision for a while. Perhaps there are some here tonight who laid to rest in cold earth a little form, a sweet child. I do not seek to stir up your feelings, but you remember how the burning tears came to your eyes, you rebelled in your soul when a child was taken away. There was an aching void in your heart and you murmured. That life was only taken and planted in another garden, and when you get on the other side, you will know your child. But not as a babe, for all grow to full spiritual stature, radiant, glorious in immortality, with soul filled with love for you, neve more to part. Is it not worth striving for? There is no condemnation to those who are good, those who are living the life, those who are seeking to do that which is right. Let me tell you, that the time is coming when all earth problems, religions, and theology, will pass away. Men are tired of such discussions. They are sick in their soul of being told to trust in another. They cannot fathom the scheme or plan of salvation, but they do know that around about them is a world of misery, of unhappiness, of shortcomings. It is only the true spiritual philosophy which teaches man to rely upon himself and become his own savior by being true to himself. There is no religion higher than truth. To serve God he must serve man. That pleases the Father and continues eternally. We must become servants of each other. Chapter 5 The Life Mass. I have thought a little and labored long to comprehend the economy of nature. I have found life everywhere, in trees and flowers and growing grains, in rapid brooks, and lazy streams, in the wind sweeping over the hills, and at rest in lonely places, in the majesty and glory of the dawn as the sun climbs the eastern sky, in the glow of evening and in the purple solitude of night. I see life seeking better expression and individual growth in every birth, and rocked in every cradle. I see nature working out its destiny, reproducing, increasing, and developing, and in such a presence I know that nothing, not even death itself, can diminish or stop the eternal progress of a single life, all a part of one stupendous whole. We speak of inert matter, but there is no such thing in the universe. Matter, the expression and language of which we do not understand, we term inert, an error caused by our lack of knowledge. Nothing dead exists. We have little knowledge of the very small, and know nothing of the world of life forms invisible to the human eye, how they live, what they do, or how they communicate with one another. There is a query in science as to whether every living thing is capable of thinking, and I am free to say that, in my judgment, wherever there is life, there must be thinking. I care not whether science accept or reject the theory, there is the power of intelligent action in every seed that has a living germ. The acorn has sense enough to send its rootlets into the earth, and its trunk and foliage branch up into the air, and select just such elements as will make the oak tree, and reject such as would be proper only for the beech tree. And the grass has the same kind of intelligence in choosing proper nourishment for itself, and the power of choice must involve the power of thought. Science is on the material and rudimental plane yet, and has much to ascertain. Speaking of the life mass, one in the next life had said, "The basis of all matter is electricity, the basis of all electricity, for there are many kinds, is ether, not that ether which is found in the atmosphere, but a subtle ether of which men know little or nothing. The basis of this subtle ether is spirit, therefore, all that there is of whirling planets, of brilliant constellations, suns, moons, and satellites, all that there is in the physical universe is ether clothed, in reality but an expression of spirit. It is the physical in and through which spirit functions, and in that way makes itself manifest to the external sense. When we once realize how infinitely great is the universe, how wondrous, How terrible, yet how beautiful in its simplicity, a feeling not exactly of awe, but of benign thankfulness must rise in our hearts at the knowledge that we are part of that stupendous system. Until the discovery of lenses and magnifying glasses, man had no idea of the world around him. He could not scan the heavens by night, nor did he know anything of the world in a drop of water or in the ice gem.